It is said that Napoleon, passing a synagogue on the fast day of Tisha B'Av, heard the sounds of lamentation. "What are the Jews crying for?" he asked one of his officers. "For Jerusalem," the soldier replied. "How long ago did they lose it?" "More than 1,700 years. A people who can mourn for Jerusalem so long will one day have it restored to them," the emperor is reputed to have replied. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 112. Hope cometh in the morning. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in an eloquent reflection on the Joseph story, notes a cryptic midrashic comment offered an explanation for why, long after Joseph had disappeared from the home of Jacob, the elderly patriarch refused to move on, refused to cease his grieving. Jacob, the rabbis remark, resisted consolation for Joseph's appearing passing because Joseph was still alive. The point, as Rabbi Sacks understands it, is that though it was Jacob himself who, seeing the bloody coat of many colors, cried out in pain, "Chaya ra'a chalatu tarav toraf Yosef," Joseph has surely been devoured by a wild animal, Jacob was nevertheless still unsure whether that is what had truly happened and refused to give up hope that Joseph was still alive. That is why he continued to grieve for his absence without accepting consolation, without ceasing his mourning. As Rabbi Sacks put it, quote, "There are laws in Judaism about the limits of grief, shiva, shloshim, a year. There is no such thing as a bereavement for which grief is endless. The Talmud says that God admonishes one who weeps beyond the appointed time. You are not more compassionate than I." And yet Jacob refuses to be comforted. A midrash gives a remarkable explanation. "One can be comforted for one who is dead, but not for one who is still living," it says. In other words, Jacob refused to be comforted because he had not yet given up hope that Joseph was still alive. End quote. There are, in other words, situations of grief where, as Rabbi Sacks further reflects, quote, "Continuing anguish is a form of loyalty. To give up, to mourn, to be reconciled to loss is a kind of betrayal. In such cases, grief lacks closure. To refuse to be comforted is to refuse to give up hope." End quote. This, as Rabbi Sacks himself notes, is also an accurate description of the Jewish reaction to the destruction of the temple, a massive manifestation of mourning, an enormous outpouring of grief that at its heart was also an expression of hope. And this is perhaps embodied above all in the actions of those that, in the age of Aelia Capitolina, may have violated the Roman ban on Jews in Jerusalem in order to mourn at the locus of Jewish devotion. The goal of the Roman persecution, of the de-Judification of Jerusalem, of the renaming of Judea as Syria Palestina, was nothing less than the attempt to undo the status of the Jews as a people. Martin Goodman notes how different the Romans' actions in the Holy Land were from those taken by the Romans in other parts of the empire. Quote, "Despite revolts in Pannonia, Germany, and Britain, the Romans continued to call each province after the name of its native people. Only the Judaei ceased to have a homeland because of what they had done. Nor was transfer of populations a standard Roman procedure. Under Augustus, some of the inhabitants of the Spanish highlands were compelled to move down into the coastal plains as a precaution against insurrection, and more generally, the Celtic peoples of Northern Europe who had sought security in hilltop forts were moved after Roman conquest into urban centers on lower ground, less easily fortified against Rome by the disaffected. But these precautionary measures were quite different from the mass punishment to which the Jews of Judea were subjected. In the eyes of Rome and at the behest of Hadrian, the Jews had ceased to exist as a nation in their own land." End quote. The persecution of the Jews, the renaming of Judea, the renaming of Jerusalem, the banning of Jews from Jerusalem, all this marked an attempt to undo the peoplehood of the Jews, and yet a people the Jews remained, and Judaism remained a faith that was centered on Jerusalem. And it appears that even as Jews were not supposed to enter the vicinity of Jerusalem, even though, as Goodman cites from Eusebius, quote, "Hadrian commanded that by a legal decree and ordinances, the whole nation should be absolutely prevented from entering thenceforth, even the district around Jerusalem, so that not even from a distance could it see its ancestral soil," end quote. Nevertheless, there were those who could not be kept away. Goodman again, quote, "Occasional hints in rabbinic texts compiled in the 4th century and later suggest that, despite the prohibition by Hadrian on Jewish settlement in the city, in practice, Jews had been visiting the site of the temple in small numbers by at least since the early 3rd century CE. End quote. In other words, there were those who risked the opprobrium or punishment of the Romans in order to commune with God in the destroyed but still sacred city of Jerusalem. Perhaps the most poignant report of such prayer comes from the Babylonian Talmud, which gives us the following story of Rabbi Yossi, a student of Rabbi Akiva. In this tale, Rabbi Yossi was traveling and chose, to stop over and pray in Jerusalem, and to pray the usual lengthy prayer, rather than an abridged version that was also a possibility for travelers. Rabbi Yossi, we are further told in the Talmud, was watched over during this process, during this prayer, by Elijah the prophet, because a destroyed building is itself a dangerous edifice to occupy. And in the very process of prayer, Rabbi Yossi discovered that God himself continued to stay in Jerusalem and weep, cry, mourn every day, several times a day. I cite the Sonsino translation of the Talmud, and we must carefully ponder the language and layers of the story here. Quote, "It has been taught. Rabbi Yossi says, I was once traveling on the road and I entered into one of the ruins of Jerusalem in order to pray. Elijah of blessed memory appeared and waited for me at the door till I finished my prayer. After I finished my prayer, he said to me, 'Peace be with you, my master.' And I replied, 'Peace be with you, my master and teacher.' And he said unto me, 'My son, why did you go into this ruin?' I replied, 'To pray.' He said to me, 'You ought to have prayed on the road.' I replied, 'I feared lest passersby might interrupt me.' He said to me, 'You ought to have said an abbreviated prayer.' Thus I then learned from him three things. One must not go into a ruin. One may say the prayer on the road, and if one does say his prayer on the road, he recites an abbreviated prayer. He further said to me, 'My son, what sound did you hear in this ruin?' I replied, 'I heard a divine voice cooing like a dove and saying, "Woe to the children, on account of whose sins I destroyed my house and burnt my temple and exiled them among the nations of the world." And he said to me, 'By your life and by your head, not in this moment alone does it so exclaim, but thrice each day does it exclaim thus. And more than that, whenever the Israelites go into the synagogues and schoolhouses and respond, "May his great name be blessed," the Holy One, blessed be he, shakes his head and says, "Happy is the king who is thus praised in this house. Woe to the father who had to banish his children, and woe to the children who had to be banished from the table of their father." End quote. However literally we read the story, the point itself can be discerned. Rabbi Yossi traveling cannot seem to refrain from entering Jerusalem, even though he lived in a period when public prayer in Jerusalem, or indeed the very presence of Jews in Jerusalem, was a violation of the laws of the empire. Rabbi Yossi enters one of the ruins of the sacred city and prays. He discovers that God mourns three times a day in the sacred city for the loss of the temple and for the lack of the presence of God's people therein. We are further informed, he is further informed, that the prayers said three times a day by Jews in the synagogue are intended to parallel the three periods of God's daily mourning, so that for Jews to say the words of the Kaddish in the synagogue, "May his great name be blessed, Yehi Shmei Rabba Mevarach," is, apparently, a way of consoling God for the loss of his temple, for God too is in mourning. Scholars such as Yonah Frankel note that the emphasis in the story on the importance of praying in the synagogue is meant to be an encouragement to Jews to focus on the future of Jewish life, to pray in what had become the center of Jewish life. And yet I would also note that while the Talmud tells us that the prayers said in the synagogue do indeed offer some source of solace to the Almighty, that they do in this anthropomorphic description seem to have its intended effect, at the same time we are also informed that the consolation is not complete, that the divine grief continues. For thrice, three times a day, we are told in the Talmud, God still cries. And if he cries, that means that God, as it were, has himself not given up on the temple and his people. He longs for its return and their return. And this means that for Jews to mourn in the ruins of Jerusalem is to imitate God's mourning, and that to long for the temple is to imitate the Almighty's longing. We do not know how many Jews made it into Aelia Capitolina during this period to mourn, to wail, to pray, to commune with the God who, according to the Talmud, was himself in mourning there. Referring to another rabbi of the period, Goodman further writes that, quote, "Later rabbis preserved the tradition that a group of pupils of Rabbi Meir founded a small holy community in Jerusalem in the Severan period, although there is no reference to any Jewish settlement in the city by the time of Constantine," end quote. What is clear is that Talmudic passages, such as the description of Rabbi Yossi, set the stage for a continued Jewish mourning in Jerusalem and a cleaving to Jerusalem, made manifest most famously, ultimately, at the Wailing Wall. And texts such as these set the stage for a theme that we will see again and again in this part of our story, Jews using every opportunity to cleave to the stones of Jerusalem and to the Temple Mount, ensuring that their mourning reflected the fact that they had never given up hope. Rabbi Sachs further reflected, quote, "It is said that Napoleon, passing a synagogue on the fast day of Tisha B'Av, heard the sounds of lamentation. 'What are the Jews crying for?' he asked one of his officers. 'For Jerusalem,' the soldier replied. 'How long ago did they lose it?' 'More than 1,700 years. A people who can mourn for Jerusalem so long will one day have it restored to them,' the emperor is reputed to have replied. Jews," Rabbi Sachs continued, "are the people who refuse to be comforted because they never gave up hope. Jacob did eventually see Joseph again. Rachel's children did return to the land. Jerusalem is once again the Jewish home. All the evidence may suggest otherwise. It may seem to signify irretrievable loss, a decree of history that cannot be overturned, a fate that must be accepted. Jews never believed the evidence because they had something else to set against it. A faith, a trust, an unbreakable hope that proved stronger than historical inevitability. It is not too much to say that Jewish survival was sustained in that hope. And that hope came from a simple, or perhaps not so simple, phrase in the life of Jacob. End quote. To refuse to be consoled, to continue to grieve, this marked Jewish life from Jerusalem's very fall. And this was no mere malaise. It was, rather, one of Jewish history's most hopeful aspects of all. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.